I was anything but a reader. I did not read books. So standing up here today and with what we have done, how did I get to where I am? So I was going to college in upstate New York, and I got sick my senior year, needed to come home. Needed a part-time job, so I went to work for a local independent bookstore. And again, not a reader. And I didn't realize at the time that I was stepping into a bookstore that the owner was a bookselling icon. Her name was Joan Ripley, is Joan Ripley. She was the first woman president of the American Booksellers Association. And more importantly, Joan was known by virtually every publisher as a tastemaker. The store, 2,000 square foot general store, it was a fixture in the community. But even more importantly to me, Joan took a 20-something year old girl who didn't read for pleasure and turned her into an avid, passionate reader. I have no idea how she did that. Still don't have any idea. Wish I could learn. But I do owe her everything for that gift. And she instilled the passion of reading for me and the passion for books. I grew up in a small town north of New York City that nobody heard of until the Clintons moved in, called Chappaqua, New York. No lease. Expensive rent. Sadly. Okay. So I graduate college, but loved managing Second Story. And, of course, my parents, you know, it's not exactly a job that pays you well. And my parents said, you need a job that has benefits. Great. So Joan suggested that I contact this organization that was about 20 minutes away or so called the American Booksellers Association. And that I could stay in and around bookselling. I could get a job that pays with benefits. Great. So not long after that conversation, in walks a staff member of ABA. And I talk to them. And they say, you know what, I think there might be a job at ABA. But before we get to ABA, Len, you have a background in bookselling.
Right. So I've worked in university chain independent bookstores. I started at the NYU. Before I dropped out of NYU, I worked at the NYU bookstore for a couple of years. I worked in the stationery department, the trade and textbook department. I worked at an independent, which was a remnant of the old Booksmith chain in Yonkers, New York, at the Cross County Shopping Center. I worked for Atlantic Books. Anybody remember Atlantic Books? They were a remainder bookseller primarily, 80% remainders, 20% mostly mass market. That was in Atlantic City, where our band had gone to live in the drummer's mother's beach house. And then I wound up at Walden Books. I loved books, music, and film. Like, these were the things that have driven me my entire life. Walden Books was very, very corporate, and I wanted out of there. And I saw a job listed, and I'm, as you can tell, I'm older than Kristen. I saw a job listed for the American Booksellers Association. I went in, applied, and got it. And I did a whole number of different things there. I started as our industry relations manager. In fact, must have been 1993 or 94. There used to be something called the Rocky Mountain Publishers Association. That's PubWest, right? So I was invited to come speak at a meeting. It was one of my very first speaking gigs, and it was the year ABA sued all the publishers. And I went in there. It was a lunchtime meeting, and that room tore me to shreds. I remember saying when I heard you wanted to have me for lunch, I didn't quite know what you meant. But I did that. I was our communications director. I started our e-commerce project, then called BookSense.com, now IndieCommerce. And when I was doing that, this young woman from a local bookstore in Chappaqua, who was referred by one of my staff members, came in to apply for a job. She was smoking hot. And I thought, I can't hire her. She's too good looking. So I actually had her back for a second interview because you never want to hire for that reason. But I hired Kristen. We worked together for several months as employer and employee. And then Kristen got transferred to another part of the company. And at that point, we became friends. And why don't you talk a little bit about your ABA background, what you did once you got out of IndieCommerce.
So. Okay. So as Len said, I was working for him for about 6 months. And then I got a job with Oren Tyker, who is currently the CEO of ABA. And I did I was there for about a decade until I left after our second son was born. And I did everything, which everyone does there. Industry relations, membership, communications, marketing, helping open bookstores. I was the ABA liaison to the regional associations. I spent a lot of time with meeting and event planning, like Winter Institute and Book Expo America. It was a hard time. It was hard to leave ABA.
You're not going to tell the Winter Institute story?
No, because you've been making some comments that I'm not really pleased about.
Okay, so, and by the way, we're going someplace with all of it. We're building to something here. So, who's familiar with ABA's Winter Institute? Okay, so ABA in 2005, then-President Mitchell Kaplan of Books and Books, said, you know, BEA is settling in New York. We need to bring education to our members in other parts of the country. And we need some sort of institute. So Avon Domnitz, who was then CEO, called Kristen and I in, said, I want a project for the two of you to work together. We're going to develop this education thing called Winter Institute. And he gave us our marching orders, said, go. We left his office, and we looked at each other and said, this is a problem because we're dating and no one here knows it and we can't work on this project together. So we went back into Avon's office and told him, and he said, stop. Everyone here knows you're dating. It's fine. So anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted. Go ahead.
So it is like a family, but it really was hard to leave ABA. And I, of course, had to take on independent projects because I couldn't let go. I love this industry. I love books. And I did a couple things. I ran the art auction to raise money for ABA's Free Speech Foundation. I created a fundraising strategy for BINC, which is the charitable organization for brick-and-mortar bookstores. And as I was doing all this stuff, Len left ABA and went to...
Well, but before we do that, the reason Kristen left... Boys, stand up. Come over here. Wave. So Kristen left ABA when Luke, our younger son, was born. I left ABA because I was at ABA. I followed digital. I was ABA's digital guy when I was there. And in 2010, 2011, coming out of still really reeling from the Great Recession, ABA took a big hit. Independent booksellers were reeling. I started to see some writing on the wall. And most of the prognosticators, including me, saw a future that was heavily based on digital. And I thought, okay, maybe I ought to do something else and start to think about how else I can participate in publishing. So I left for the Book Industry Study Group. In case you're not familiar with BISG, it's a member-based organization that does standards, best practices, research and education on behalf of the industry, and you get to see everything. When I was there, we did a thing called Bookstats, which was all of the book industry numbers across the board. So I became immersed in data and in standards and in operations. And when you're in New York, and I'll talk about this a little later, New York, you might know this out here, I didn't know it till I moved here, exists in a kind of bubble. Where everybody is kind of frenetic and crazy. Ebooks, oh my God, ebooks, we have to drop our print strategy. We've got to do everything digital tomorrow. And it really is irrational at some point because it's at such a frenzied pace. Just very briefly, the other thing I started doing at this time is I developed a writing career. I had a young adult novel published in 2014 from Egmont USA. They went out of business. They had signed me for a sequel. Lerner Publishing in Minnesota picked up the rights. The sequel Scargirl publishes, Lucas, stop that, settle down, publishes March 1st, and then I have two more books coming from Bloomsbury in 2017 and 2018. So anyway, this brings us to the end of the who we are thing. We were happy family. I had this good job, high-profile job at BISG. Kristen was taking care of our kids. So put all that aside. And now let's talk a little bit about the book industry. Okay, so I want to talk about, and I'm going to sort of just take over here for a minute, about key points of disruption in the history of the book industry. Starting in 1450 with the death of the noted Croatian poet Marko Marulić. Well, I'm glad some of you were laughing, because that had nothing to do with anything. 1450 was the Gutenberg press. Not a lot happened, but the next thing that matters to us is in the 1930s, the introduction of paperback books. Paperback books were going to be the death of hardcovers. Okay, that, you know, that was, I think it was Simon and Schuster who started it. They were going to be the death of hardcovers. Flash forward to the 1970s, Crown Books starts discounting. This is going to be the death of book retail. Okay, in 1995, Amazon launches and e-commerce. Again, the death of retail. And what happens, by the way, in between 97 and 95, is a massive expansion of chain mall stores and superstores. And in fact, the total square footage devoted, retail square footage devoted to selling books in that time tripled. Okay? The industry did not triple, but the place where these books were being sold, and then when you factor in the online, it's actually hard to measure. And then, of course, in 2008, Amazon launches Kindle, actually almost a year after Sony launches their e-reader. And then that's another point of disruption. And shame on you for giving a Kindle as a prize when you invite us here to keynote. I'm just going to say that. So I love you, Kent. You know, I'm just giving you a hard time. So this brings us to 2011. And e-books at that point were, as everyone will recall, were on a runaway curve. Now, if you've seen me present before, you may have seen this chart. My all-time favorite chart.
We see it at home at dinner sometimes. He loves this chart.
Thank you, dear. Everybody's good on this, right? I'll move on?
Yeah.
Okay. This is the adoption curve chart. What this is showing along the x-axis is time. It's the 20th century, 1900 to 1999. The y-axis, from the bottom to the top, is penetration, percent penetration into U.S. households from 0 to 100. And what we're showing is how technology has been adopted in America. That blue line there, so starting before 1900, but curving up like that, anybody want to guess what that blue line is?
Radio.
No, it's a good guess, though. Telephone. How about that one?
Television.
Wow. You saw this before, right? How about that one? No, trick question. Color television. And you can see how quickly color television, once, because we were so already immersed in television, color television. Okay, and then this last little blue line right here in the 1990s. Anybody want to guess what that is? Okay, this is also a trick question. It's starting to curve back over. It's telephone pagers. Okay, so not every technology that is adopted continues that curve up. Now, just because people didn't want telephone pagers didn't mean they didn't want mobile telephony, right? Cell phones and then later smartphones came and replaced that. But it shows that not everything is the case. And what we saw starting from 2010 to 2011, e-books doubled from a less than $1 billion a year to more than $2 billion a year. From 2011 to 2012, they grew from just over $2 to just over $3 billion a year. We were on this hockey stick curve up. And then from 2012 to 2013, it hit the wall, and e-books flattened out completely. 2013 to 2014, they actually flattened out and lost a little. And then I love these kinds of charts. I'll explain this in a second. This is growth for the first 9 months of the last calendar year. And what this chart shows is I'm just going to come over here and talk loud. The inner circles, so that one's minus 20%, minus 10% growth, up to plus 50% growth. And what you can see is ebooks are in a negative space. Paperback books grew. Other is a very small percentage of all this. It's just odd formats. Hardbacks were about flat. Digital audio has, for all intents and purposes at this point, replaced physical media audio. Physical media audio is going away. But not print books. Not print books. This is on the adult side. This is on the kid side. ebooks retreated on children's and young adult almost 50%. These numbers are from AAP, by the way, in the first 9 months of last year. And you can see hardcover books, again, were, I think that's just about flat to down a little. Paperback books doing very well. Mass market books have taken the biggest hit during this time. But what is going on? This is not what anyone expected. Not at all. And I think what we're seeing is print books and digital books have found a way to coexist. So what are the reasons for that? And this is just personal and anecdotal. If you think about digital music, okay, again, like digital audio, digital music is physical music is largely going away. Vinyl's made a great comeback, but CDs are kind of disappearing because people use streaming services or they download individual tunes. Experientially, listening to a digital song coming from a streaming service or listening to it from a vinyl record, unless you're a real audiophile, is pretty much the same. It's noise coming through a speaker or through a headphone, and you're enjoying it. Experientially, reading a book and reading an ebook, without making comments about which is better, print, there's no difference. I mean, it's all different. It's a complete difference. It's just a different experience. And in fact, there's lots of studies that show reading comprehension on screens isn't as strong. Younger people complain of screen fatigue. They actually are reading print much more than people thought. It's been a much slower transition to digital textbooks. And we see this especially in nonfiction. The ebook phenomenon, most of you know this, has been a phenomenon of fiction. It is a phenomenon of fiction, not just genre fiction, really, started that way, but all fiction. But when you're reading a nonfiction book, you flip from chapter to chapter, you go to the index, you go to photographs. The book is still a better technology unless you have to travel or you're carrying because of its bulk. Do I think ebooks are going away? Of course not. But what we're seeing is a world in which they're going to coexist. Radio was supposed to be the death of movies, television, the death of movies and radio, and everything has seemed to manage to coexist because people behave differently at different times. And this ultimately is all about consumer behavior. So here's where our two worlds come back to meet. The Vallejos family is in 2012 and 2013, I've got this good job, Kristen's home with boys, and then the book industry is now pivoting or not pivoting in an unexpected way. So now we come to why tattered cover and why now. So
we had a tiny house on a busy cut-through street in a lousy school district, and Len was commuting 3 hours round trip from New York City every day. We looked at each other and said, this is no way to live.
So, as I said, people there kind of live in a bubble and you forget there's another way to live all over the world. So we started calling friends that we knew. And we called the Eiffel Tower. I was at the American Library Association show in Las Vegas, and one of the people we called was Joyce Meskis. And when I started at ABA in 1992, Joyce was the president at that time. Joyce is the current owner of Tattered Cover and has been for many, many years. And I called her thinking maybe there are jobs for someone like me in Denver because she knew me. And we talked for a while. She had some ideas for jobs, university press things, consulting things. And then Joyce, in her very quiet, reserved way at the end of the call, said, so do you have any interest in the store? It's like, well, she can't mean Tattered Cover. What store would that be, Joyce? Because it's Tattered Cover. And she said Tattered Cover. So we talked. It was just serendipity. Joyce, at that point, was looking for a succession plan. Her children weren't interested in the business. The staff were at an age where they were more risk-averse. And she had decided she was just going to do it until she couldn't do it anymore, and then her kids would probably sell the business, which made her very sad. This has been her life. And in a lot of ways, Joyce has defined the modern American independent bookstore and bookseller. So we just happened along at the right moment. We talked for 9 months.
Let me just add that why Colorado and why Denver? After college, I needed, before I went to ABA, I needed a place to go that wasn't the town I grew up in. And I decided on Colorado because a lot of the part-time moms who worked there had kids living out there, so I heard about it all the time. I went out there, spent a weekend, and fell in love with it. And I spent a couple years out there, and throughout our travels with many travels with ABA and stuff, and Len has been there too, we've always loved Colorado, which is why we started, our first call was to Joyce in Colorado. So when she did say, you know, how about the store, we were like, well, yes, and we'll figure out how the heck to do that later. I mean, how do you not take advantage of an opportunity like that? And we were ready, and we did. And I think that having two industry, publishing industry, bookselling people who know a lot more than probably we should, why would we jump into this and go into an independent bookstore? We are making a big statement about our beliefs and our vision for the future of bookselling in general and publishing. And I mean, we're putting all of our eggs in a single basket with two young kids, lifting up our lives and moving across the country. And that's the statement we're making. And
yeah. So I'm getting lots of invitations now to speak, like, and the question generally is, so why are you doing this? Because everything you know, why are you doing this? And we are. We're sort of pledging our lives, our fortunes, our sacred honor that we believe that this is the future. I do just have to add, the reason I have this picture here is I called Joyce while sitting in the shadow of the giant fake Eiffel Tower. It was an incredibly important moment in my life, which sort of bookends a moment. If I'm nothing if not cliche, I proposed to Kristen
at the Eiffel Tower
in the real one.
On so, Valentine's
yeah,
Day.
So I'm cliche. So
works for me.
Anyway, so that's where these two worlds meet. What we're going to do now is tell you a little bit about Tattered Cover, and then we want to talk about both the future and about the relationship between indie bookstores and publishers. And I know we're a little behind, so we'll...
As well known as Tattered Cover is in the publishing industry, it is 10 times better known in Denver. It's an institution. Joyce Meskis bought a 900-square-foot bookstore in 1973 and turned it into an empire. The store faced all the challenges that every independent bookstore faced, the chain superstore expansion, the rise of e-commerce, the introduction of ebooks, the Great Recession, but she and her team pivoted and reinvented at every turn, and she is passing off to us a healthy, vibrant business. See what we have to live up to? So,
wait, I just have to jump in there. When the deal was announced, the Denver Post the next day ran an editorial, and the editorial was about Joyce Meskis, local treasure. And then it named Kristen and I by name and basically said, you better not mess this up. Welcome to Colorado.
Okay, so Tattered Cover has four stores and then three more at the airport. The flagship store, really, on Colfax Avenue is more than 20,000 square feet, built in an old theater. Thank you. Our downtown location, we call Lodo, which is now the longest tenured store, is about 12,000 square feet and is in part responsible for the revitalization of Denver's downtown district. Our newest store in Littleton, which is a suburb of Denver, is about 8,000 square feet, and we kind of helped move it from another suburb called Highlands Ranch into here, and Len and I were part of that. We came out last March, and we kind of have a little affinity, so it might be our favorite store, but we're not saying. And then we have our newest store, well, our second newest store, a tiny store in Union Station, which is the refurbished rail hub, which is perfectly placed considering the planned expansion of Denver's light rail system. All right, and then the three airport stores, we have a partnership with Hudson News. They operate them and use our branding. So it's a nice relationship. And then we have a very robust schedule of events, a significant outside sales business, and we own and operate cafes in three of the four locations.
So Some of the challenges we face coming in, one is tissue rejection, right? So Joyce has been the owner for 40 years, the general manager, Matt, 43 years. Matt Miller has been there for 38 years. Our buyer has been there for 40 years. This is a very long tenured staff. The community knows the store. So that's one issue is tissue rejection from the community. Was that not up there? We don't know what we don't know.
Wait. Can I add one thing on the challenges? This isn't easy, and it is in all of the wonderful aspects of it that you can all imagine. It is overwhelming, it is exhausting, and it's a lot. And I find myself and have found myself struggling, and we were at a conference, and I discovered something in one of the sessions that I realized this is what I've been struggling with. I come to Tatter Cover, and I have credibility in the industry. I know booksellers. I know that side of it. No one knows me at Tatter Cover. No one knows me in Denver. And it's the personal credibility there that is I have identified as what is really struggling and what I need to overcome personally. And I have identified it, and it is now my job to figure out how to change that. So just as one more, like a personal challenge, because it's not easy.
My personal challenge is sleep. We don't know. We come in with this. Every day is like a sip of water from a fire hose at Tatter Cover. We're very well situated to come in and do this, which is why Joyce, really handpicked us. But we're learning a lot all the time, and then we're coming in as partners. So how do we divide what we do? So those are some of the challenges. Let's talk briefly about the future from 30,000 feet. Don't screw it up. Trust the professionals. There is a very long tenured staff there, and we need to trust them. At the same time, though, a fresh set of eyes is good. So we're in the process now of analysis, and we are completely analyzing every bit of the business and learning to trust the data. And sometimes trusting the professionals and trusting the data, you don't get the same answer, and we've got to use our best instincts to figure out to carve the path forward while continuing the legacy of Tattered Cover. At the ground level, we just bought a brand new computer system. Bookstores, independent bookstores, for years have been on legacy computer systems, and we have a great relationship with our current provider, but it was not scalable. It was very outdated technology, and even their newer version was written 13 years ago. So we just partnered with a company called NetSuite. It's a cloud-based system that would allow us to access any kind of data anywhere. We're going to touchscreen terminals. We'll be able to double-section things in store, more merchandising and marketing power. Our general ledger will be now connected to our sales all in one end-to-end system. So our ability to give you data and to partner on new things with you grows exponentially because of this. So this was step one. We made that purchase in December. We're rolling it out in July. Another thing we're doing.
Tatter Cover does not have a history of doing a lot with the schools in the area. And we identified that and are putting full force into creating those relationships and what opportunities are out there. Because we, with the schools, share the goal of let's get kids to read and let's instill in them a lifelong love of reading, like Joan Ripley did to me. I want to pass on. And then we're also taking a look at our cafe business. We need to really do an intense review and see why the numbers look the way they do and how to reinvent it, if you will. And
publicly, the numbers look great. Okay. So that brings us to how we relate with you. How do independent bookstores and publishers relate? And I want you to think back now. Go back in the Wayback Machine and think 30 years back, okay? And think about how you were doing business then compared to how you're doing business today. So today you're doing much more on-demand printing with digital print technologies. we're communicating today versus 30 years ago almost entirely electronically. Booksellers are much more diversified now with our product mixes. We're not just books. We've had to diversify. It's a very different product mix. Books are distributed in new formats, often simultaneously, which is something that would have been unthinkable then. We're doing a lot different. Yet the business model, the fundamental business model between publishers and booksellers has been unchanged for decades. That business model doesn't acknowledge, in my opinion, or say our opinion, the importance of the warm, inviting spaces we bring consumers and surround them with books. Our serving brick-and-mortar retailers, I'll include the chains here, as your most important merchandising and marketing arm. We are, in effect, your merchandising and marketing arm. It doesn't acknowledge the importance of putting authors and readers in the same room. By the way, that I love that display. That's from Blue Willow Bookshop in Houston, Texas. But happily, we're starting to see some things change from both large and small publishers. Penguin Random House obviously can do things others can't because they have more money, you know, than the Pope. And their rapid replenishment program is revolutionizing how we source product. And we're seeing other large publishers start to do that now too, and it increases their business with us and allows us to much better manage our inventory turns. Chelsea Green, we're on a consignment relationship with, right? Which gives them dedicated merchandising space in our store, and it means we're not tying up cash on the shelves and inventory. In a bookstore, most of our cash is on the shelf in the form of a book, which means we're undercapitalized. So it's hard to buy new computer systems. It's hard to open new locations to merchandise and market more of your books. So what I would hope that you take away from this is to understand that we're partners, and we're partners in the sense that we're true partners, that you be bold, you be creative, throw some spaghetti against the wall and talk to us, because we act like partners, not like overlords, just saying. That there's a lot of opportunity here to break down some of the walls. No one wants anything altruistically. We want to sell more of your books, and we want you to sell more of your books. Collectively, independent bookstores have millions and millions of eyeballs coming through their store and sell hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of books every year. You deal with this individually, but collectively as a channel, it's potent. And we're the ones who are often making whatever that next book is. And we're the ones who are going to be most interested in helping and working with small presses and mid-sized presses as well. What keeps us up at night? Charlie and Luke and our cat. The economy. Honest worries about the economy now that we're business owners. I watch the stock market. I didn't really used to do that. Amazon.com. They have more money than Penguin Random House. And honestly, the news about erroneous news about 300 to 400 bookstores had everybody sit up the other day. But even opening a dozen bookstores, what does that mean for us? They are so well funded by the public markets, a mystery to me for a company that hardly ever returns a profit. But they can dictate a lot of what happens. Publishers in the last 10 years, especially the big ones, because you guys have always known this, the big ones have kind of woken up and gone, wait a minute, maybe they're not this wonderful panacea that we thought. And in fact, maybe they're our biggest competitor. We're concerned about the future of reading. You know, who knows? Who can tell me what this is? Crack cocaine. About 20% of you right now are checking this. And when you walk out of the room, 90% of you will look at it, not just at your email. You'll check Facebook. You'll catch up on Words with Friends. You'll do whatever. This is distracting from reading time. That's a serious thing, because the less people read, the worse we are as a culture. And you could point perhaps to some things in the culture right now that suggest that maybe that's true. And then we're keeps us up at night about screwing it up. And then a final thought from Kristen.
Yeah, so just a few minutes ago, Len said, if you take anything away from this, take this away. Be bold, creative, throw spaghetti at the wall, talk to us, you know. I want to send you away with something, too. And how I'm looking at what I'm bringing to Tatter Cover and what I want to bring forward in the future is everything that I look at, touch, talk about, I ask myself the question, how can I make this special and unique? And if I can give you anything, is ask yourselves in professional or personal life, how are you making something special and unique? Because that's how you're going to stand out and that's how you're going to succeed.
Thank you.